KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I'm rounding out a fellowship at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. I am very happy to have back on the show Professor Al Roberts of the University of Missouri Truman School of Public Affairs, who authored a book that came out earlier this year, which is sadly and amazingly incredibly timely. The book is entitled The Four Crises of American Democracy: Representation, Mastery, Discipline, Anticipation, published out of Oxford University Press. Al has been on the show in the past. He was on at least once, maybe twice, regarding his groundbreaking work on government secrecy, work that has opened up a field in that area, and work that's really foundational in understanding the nature of secrecy in democracies. In this book, The Four Crises of American Democracy, Al's core thesis is that there's kind of, which would be interesting to discuss in light of recent events, that there's a general stasis and malaise around Western democracy as we understand it. And in the book, Al brings us his significant insight into the nature of four of these problems, and then thinks about where we can go with them. As always, Al's books are very thoughtful, extremely well-researched, and extremely timely from a policy perspective. And so as we're recording this show on May 31st, where during the overnight the president tweeted something indecipherable a few minutes after midnight, which then caused the New York Times and the world to kind of figure out what was happening. We have a lot to talk about, and I'll be curious to talk to Al about whether, in light of the election results and where we stand there, he would still identify these as four crises or whether we have entered new ones. So Al's book, written for a broad audience, focuses on these four areas that we will be defining as we go through them. Representation focuses, according to Al, on the lack of real public control over government, as he explains it. Of particular interest to me, as well as to Hearsay Culture listeners, is the issue that Al identifies as mastery, how to deal competently with problems identified by the public, as Al explains it. He also focuses on discipline, which is an interesting topic, which he defines as excessive or unreasonable demands that people impose on their governments. And rounding it out is the issue of anticipation, which is, according to Al again, the failure of democracies to address long-term problems. And again, recording on May 31st, right before we went on the air, I thought I saw an announcement that the president will be unilaterally withdrawing from the Paris environmental agreements, which would, I think, be a primary example of where long-term planning might be an issue. So this book, to be clear, is not a book about politics, although politics plays a role, but really is a much more, I think, foundational and therefore important work on the nature of these problems. Al, by way of brief background, is currently a professor in the Truman School of Public Affairs at the University of Missouri. He's also a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. He co-edits the journal Governance. He is a lawyer, having received his degree from the University of Toronto and a PhD in public policy from Harvard. This fall, he will be moving from Missouri to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst as the director of the School of Public Policy. Al, however, still being in Missouri, is joining us via Skype from Missouri. Al, thanks for coming back on the show, and thanks for educating my listeners.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to have the chance to talk with you again.
So, Al, I asked this question of all my guests. You undoubtedly, I know you answered it a few years ago, but perhaps we can update it. Tell us a bit more, for those that haven't heard that previous interview, about your background. And again, given that this book was written last year in 2016, what brought you to write The Four Crises of American Democracy?
Well, I've written a few books recently that have been basically thinking about the way in which government, our understandings of what government is supposed to do and how it's supposed to be organized, how that evolves over time. And this particular book got going a couple of years ago, actually, and it was written before the last presidential election. But it got going back in 2014 when I noticed that a lot of people were writing books, articles, op-ed pieces with fairly dire assessments about the state of democracy, not just in the United States, but also in other places, Western Europe, other parts of the world. And writing pretty grim assessments about where democracy was headed, about the failures of democracy, the retreat of democracy. Francis Fukuyama had an article in Foreign Affairs, and I think the title was America in Decay, talking about the apparent collapse of democracy in the U.S. And what I thought I would do is write a book that's a bit of a reality check on the kind of dire assessment about where the country is heading. And what I try to do is basically say, look, we're in this period of democratic malaise, and this got started well before the presidential election, this sense of pessimism about where the country is going, its capacity to sort through problems. But the key idea of the book is that the country, the United States, has been through this before. It went through a similar period in the 1970s, went through it in the 1930s, went through it in the early 1900s, around the 1910s. It's gone through these moments of kind of a deep funk and pessimism about the capacity of democracy to cope with the challenges of the day. And the idea of the book is that every time we go through this, we're working through some new problem, some new challenge to our understanding of what government ought to be doing. So it's not just a moment of malaise, it's, in an important sense, a moment of reinvention, a moment in which we reconsider what we think democracies are supposed to do and how they're supposed to work.
So, and I really neglected to say this in the introduction. A lot of your book is indeed a history of these issues, and I think to some degree challenges some received wisdom that we think we have about the nature of our government. Perhaps you could. I'm not asking you to run through the entire history, but to contextualize the book before we dive into some of these issues. When you're approaching a book like this, I may be asking a little about craft. When you're approaching a book like this, where you're focusing on current policy topics, weaving history can sometimes be a challenge, precisely because that history itself is subject to different lenses and different views. I'm curious, as a scholar, whether, as we sit here today, you see history being something that can continue to guide us. And I think I know the answer to that question, but in light of some questions I'm going to be asking about the nature of our current problems, what's your threshold answer?
Well, yeah, and, you know, the temptation, because we're mortal and we have short lifespans, and so we sort of focus on what's in front of us, is to think, you know, it's never been as bad as it has been today. And one of the great things about a sort of appreciation of history is you begin to appreciate that, no, that's usually not true, times have been rough before. And so it helps to put things in context. And it also, you begin to see certain patterns in history that give you a sense of the way things tend to work out. And you can learn from how, you know, similar challenges were dealt with before. So I do think a sort of a historical perspective really does help. And I think to some degree it can make you feel a little less pessimistic about where we are today.
So, which of course might be music to many listeners' ears who are concerned about where we are. Let's before we get into your four particular crises, I have some questions about each. Let's more specifically, if we can, define malaise as you understand it, because you tie it initially, or recently, you tie it to the global financial crisis in 2007 to 2008. Perhaps in order to better understand the broad, critique of where we are before we get into the specific issues, what is it in the global crisis that, in your view, moved us in this direction of malaise? What experiences and what factors?
Yeah, so let me just give you, I talk about four crises, and the fourth one is the one we're in right now. Mm-hmm. And there are similarities in all of these four crises. So,
and I will ask you to define them in your own way, of course. So.
Yeah, and I'll get into the differences, you know, the particular challenges. We can get into that later on. But let me just so listeners have a sense of where I'm going with this. So, you know, the current, we sort of know where we are today. But in the 1970s, the mid-1970s, there was this sense that democracy had gone off the rails in the U.S. and Western Europe as well. You know, people might remember the infamous Carter malaise speech, which was sort of that era. There was a similar moment of democratic malaise, especially around the time that Roosevelt was inaugurated in 1933, 1934, when people thought that, you know, maybe dictatorship was the way to go. A lot of people who really admired Mussolini, non-democratic leader who seemed to have his act together. And there was a similar kind of democratic funk around about the time of the election of Woodrow Wilson and the few years before that, the sense that democracies, well, the United States wasn't a democracy at all, or that democratic systems simply couldn't get their act together. And the similarities in all of these periods, I think, three similarities. The one is this sense of malaise, this expression of the idea that democracy just can't get its act together. The second is people looking abroad and seeing non-democratic regimes that seem to be doing better. So in the 1910s, it was Imperial Germany that really seemed to be pulling ahead. In the 1930s, it was fascist Italy and fascist Germany that seemed to be pulling ahead. In the 1970s, you know, people were still talking about how the Soviet Union seemed to have the lead, or Japan seemed to be taking the lead, although Japan, of course, is a democracy, but not as fully democratic as the United States. Its power isn't as decentralized. And today, of course, people are looking at China and saying, look, there's a non-democratic regime that seems to be pulling ahead of us. And all of these periods are also distinguished by the fact that there's an economic downturn. So we got into this funk because of the global financial crisis and its aftermath. The economy was performing very poorly in the 1970s. There was the Great Depression in the 1930s. And in the earlier period, roughly, say, 1905 to 1912, there was a financial crisis in 1907, and then there was a series of pretty sharp recessions going up until the First World War. So three factors: this feeling of malaise, an economy that's performing poorly, and this sense that there's sort of non-democratic regimes out there that are pulling ahead.
So let's, because you've already, you know, in defining it that way, Al, are pushing back against, as you've already noted, some, you know, belief structures that exist regarding where we are today. So let me ask what I think is the, before we get into the specifics, let me push back on this core idea that we've, and I know I'm simplifying it, but for purposes of discussion, we've been here before. Because you, in particular, you talk about institutions in your book, and it's something I do want to get into under your mastery heading in a moment. But it would seem, as we're recording on May 31st, 2017, that at least from an institutional standpoint, the impact post-election is different. And let me give an example of what I mean. And I'm still taking this kind of at the top level, if we can, before we get into the specifics of your critique. So I read an article yesterday in the New York Times that indicated or that reported that President Trump has left a vacuum in Italy that is being filled by Putin and Russia. And the Times included the fact that the president has failed to appoint an ambassador in Italy, and made further points about how Russia, and particularly Putin, are taking advantage of the, for lack of a better phrase, the distraction of the very ironically investigations around Russia and Trump. Is that So the idea being that institutions themselves are being damaged by, in this case, failure to even appoint people to run them, and of course we could go further. But that kind of concern, which I think is kind of latent in lots of the concerns raised today, would seem to be different, or at least different than the events that you've identified now. And so that's kind of my pushback question. Have we really been here before?
Well, you know, we got to figure out what do we say about President Trump? And, you know, so this book was written before the presidential election.
Right.
And my sort of broad take on where we are and where we're going is as follows, that, you know, one of the things I argue is that in each of these crises, sometimes it's basically a crisis of ideas and institutions. And what happens is that up until the moment of crisis, there's a sort of general understanding about the way the world works, about what government is supposed to be doing, that is generally accepted. And then you get into this moment of crisis where people aren't persuaded by the prevailing paradigm anymore. They're not persuaded that it works. And there's a period of the sort of exhaustion and collapse of old ideas and the search for some kind of new paradigm. And one of the things I argue is that that process doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes many years for the old paradigm to collapse, for people to do that kind of search and reinvention, and for the new paradigm to get established. And so one of the things I would argue right now is that there was a kind of new paradigm that operated in the States, starting with Reagan or Thatcher in the UK. You know, some people call it the neoliberal paradigm. I'm going to call it the Reagan-Clinton paradigm, and I'm calling it that because it starts with Reagan, but Clinton basically consolidates it because he's the opposition party leader who basically buys in to the kind of main core of the neoliberal ideas. And I'm talking with Bill Clinton, of course. But I think what happens is our faith in that kind of neoliberal paradigm, the kind of idea of deregulation and limited government and globalization, open borders and so on, got shaken badly by the financial crisis. People aren't buying that product anymore, and they're searching for something new. And I think in the last presidential election, I mean, one of the reasons Trump won was because he did a better job than other candidates of giving voice to that public frustration with the status quo. The problem is that he really doesn't have any coherent view of where to take the country. And so part of the difficulty I think we're confronting right here is the if there was system failure, I think it was the failure of the two major political parties to do a good job of creating room for a creative discussion about what the alternative paths forward are. And Trump, I think, essentially won by default.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. And just, I mean, my own view is that the man is dangerously incompetent. So, but that's essentially how I think we got to where we are.
Yeah, I was just going to add, and this sounds slightly sycophantic, but I think that critique of the two parties is reflected pretty well in how Larry Lessig was apparently treated by the Democratic Party, and you know, as a candidate who I think at a minimum could have helped us have those kinds of discussions about core issues of democracy and how we make decisions, effectively wasn't even allowed into the debates, which, you know, are the primary vehicle, at least right now, for folks to have those discussions. So that seems to make sense. We're chatting with Professor Al Roberts of the University of Missouri on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Let me ask you one more kind of threshold question, Al, before we take each topic, and I think I'll just take them in turn based upon how you approach them. So I was just today chatting with Dave Galumbi at Virginia Commonwealth, who writes a lot about the role of technologies in information systems and processes. And he has a critique that effectively says that the language around bitcoins and cryptocurrencies mimics heavily that of the right-wing extreme, as he defines it, so the issues of libertarianism and so forth. My question is not about Bitcoin, so don't be concerned about that. My question is really more about technology. As a threshold matter, and you are quite familiar with this, indeed you've written about it, there has been, since the dawn of the commercial internet anyway, a belief that technology could solve many of the problems in democracy that you talk about and that we have talked about on this show. And yet technology has a checkered record, particularly in light of the fact that this technology existed simultaneously with, as you just pointed out, and I agree, the election of an incompetent president. As a threshold matter, what would you say about, and I know it's a hard question, but as a threshold matter, what would you say about the role of technology today in addressing the malaise, as you define it, before we get into the specifics?
Yeah, well, I've always kind of rejected the kind of utopian ideas about what the advent of new technologies was going to do to, kind of reinvigorate or breathe new life into democracy. This book actually doesn't. You could make an alternative argument about the ascension of Trump that basically says, look, one of the things that's going on here is a fundamental change in democracy is driven by technological change, and that he just happened to master a new technology that got him into office. And that's not the argument I make in the book, but you could make an argument that there's actually historical parallels there as well. There are people who were sort of, lamenting the demise of discourse and the change in politics because of the rise of Twitter and other social media. But, there were sort of equally grim assessments about what was happening to democracy because of the advent of broadcast television in the 1960s. Joe McGinnis wrote a great book called The Selling of the President in 1968 that was about the way in which television appeared to be corrupting American politics. And actually, in the 1930s, people were worried about the way in which radio was corrupting American politics. This idea that Franklin Roosevelt was using radio as a tool to build a dictatorship. So, you could tell an alternate storyline about the way in which American democracy basically deals with technological shocks. The way in which the way politics plays gets disrupted by new technology, and we learn to adapt to that new technology.
And I'm glad you used the word adapt, because I did want to close on your last chapter, which focuses on that very issue. You have made it too easy for me as an interviewer, Al, to ask you questions, because you structured the book so well. And as much as I like to be creative in my questions, I think it makes sense to address these issues in turn. And so I'm going to ask you an incredibly dull and predictable question, but this is a good way to do it. So let's talk about representation for a moment before we take a short break. So I gave the thumbnail of what you mean by representation, but let's define the problem from a malaise perspective. What is the issue of representation that you see, and what is at the core the history behind it?
Right. So, and then just the setup. I talk about four crises, four moments of history here, and a few minutes ago I said there's sort of similarities between these four moments of crisis, but there's also differences, I argue, and the key difference is that in each of these moments of history, people are grappling with a different kind of challenge to democracy. And in the first crisis I look at, the crisis, what I call the crisis of representation, which goes from about, say, 1900 up until about 1920, what I basically argue is that people are grappling with the question of whether the United States is a democracy at all. I mean, it calls itself a democracy, but women can't vote. As a practical matter, African American males can't vote. and there's a question about the inflow of immigrants into the country and the sense that immigrants are undermining American democracy. And then there's a question about the status of folks who are in territories just acquired by the United States, like the Philippines, who are subject to the sovereign power of the United States, but also don't have the right to vote. So it's a crisis of representation because, for a long time, people took for granted a system in which most people weren't allowed to vote and still called it a democracy. And that notion gets challenged profoundly in this period where people challenge the question of who ought to be allowed to participate in the American democracy. And one of the things I argue is that it takes a while to chew through that, but we come out the other end with a different understanding about enfranchisement and a different set of institutions that allow people to participate more actively in American politics.
Do we, so from, and you point this out as in this idea of representation, you talk about as is a very, common topic to the extent that we discuss these things, of course, you talk about the issues around campaign finance. Right. And as you pointed out, the common belief going back 100 years plus was that, quote, senators themselves were prepared to invest large sums to purchase their seats in the Senate because they were certain of a generous return on their investment once they reached Washington, which to some degree seems to be almost trite in its structure. And so I'm curious, under the heading of representation, how much you make of campaign finance issues as generally defined, right? The idea that both elected officials are beholden to those that make donations, but also that elected officials are crowded out from doing any other work except raising money as an issue of representation.
Yeah, and I neglected to mention that when I was talking about the crisis of representation, the other challenge to democracy in that time, or the notion that the United States was a democracy, was the sense that it was really a plutocracy.
Right.
That the rich controlled everything. And I should say, too, that one of the things that's going on today is we're trying to sort out exactly what the problem with the prevailing paradigm is today. And one of the ways we do that is by kind of looking back to history and it's asking, are we going through, for example, a crisis of representation today? The debates we have about plutocracy today really echo pretty profound, directly the debates about plutocracy 100 years ago. And in fact, when Occupy Wall Street was using the language about the power of the 1%, they were actually borrowing a figure of speech that was used pretty widely 100 years ago, this notion about the powerful 1%. Just to roll back the clock to the, say 1900, 1910, one of the things we have to remember is that not only did were most adults in the United States not able to vote, I did a little calculation and figured out that Woodrow Wilson became president in 1912, and probably 1 out of 10 adult Americans actually voted for him. Mm. But a lot of folks weren't directly elected at all. So senators at that time weren't elected by the public at large. They were chosen by state legislatures. And the allegation, which I think was often substantiated, was that state legislatures were corrupt when they chose the senators, and the senators themselves became corrupt. And one of the things that happens in that period is we change the rules of the game so that senators are directly elected. The primary system gets introduced at that time as well. A lot of jurisdictions introduce recall and ballot initiative measures. So more people end up voting in that period, and they have more things to vote for.
So where does that idea take us, again, under the heading of representation? Where does it take us as a fundamental question of the nature of participation. And I come back to this technology idea because, you know, and again, you talk about this in the book as well, right? Voter suppression remains, of course, has an awful history in this country, going back arguably to the dawn of the country. We now see that issue arise here and it or today. And you talk about these techniques, although you note the changing circumstances involving race, although that's obviously not solved, and you don't suggest that it is. How do you see that kind of tactic having an impact on malaise? And I keep coming back to this idea because you could make the argument that so long as there are efforts to suppress votes, right, there will be a counter that in a democracy should prevail. But perhaps that's too utopian. So how do you see that tension existing today?
Well, I think I'm not sure I'm going to be answering your question directly. Mm-hmm. I guess a couple of points I'm going to make are this. One of the key ideas in this book is that the American system is malleable. It's plastic. It changes its shape pretty substantially over time. You know, and we tend to sometimes not to recognize that. We tend to think that, you know, governing institutions are rigid, they're fixed, they've been around forever, and they're really, really hard to change. And if you look just at the last century of history, that's clearly not right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so even if you – and a related point is, let's suppose that by democracy we mean a system in which adult citizens are allowed to vote for key government offices, a universal adult franchise. If that's what we mean by democracy, the United States hasn't been a democracy for very long. You know, you could even argue it's only been a democracy since like the 1960s with the push through of the civil rights legislation of that decade. And you could even go to other countries and say, you know, the UK has only been a democracy in the sense of having a universal adult franchise since the late 1920s. So these are relatively young, malleable systems. And we're constantly debating about how to structure them and how to reinvent them so that they are just and sustainable over time. And so we're always kind of having this rollicking debate about how the system ought to be set up. And that's one of the things we're doing right now. Could things go off the rails? Yes, they could. You know, I mean, but the other thing is, I think it could be recreated for the better. It could be that we're doing a course correction after 30 years in which a particular paradigm prevailed, and we thought at the time maybe that it would take us in a good place, maybe it advanced the country in certain ways, but now it's exhausted itself and we have to look for a new direction.
We're chatting with Al Roberts at the University of Missouri on KZSU-FM Stamford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stamford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stamford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you consider making a donation and that you also continue to listen to the station. So, Al, let's turn, and again, this is another book where, it would make hard radio to go for hours, but it's hard to do this in an hour, and I recognize it because as much as I want to continue on the issue of representation, I do want to turn to mastery. which is a topic of particular interest to me, given, again, the nature of information technology is understood as helping democracies achieve mastery, not just among experts, but among a population. And you have serious misgivings about that. So let's define mastery again, and perhaps you could summarize that history as you understand it today.
Well, so basically, the idea of mastery is just that you know, let's suppose we establish the United States as a democracy. You know, we extend the franchise. We say, okay, we get the idea that key politicians, like the president, ought to be elected by universal adult franchise. Okay, solid on that. But then the next question is, can those elected officials actually do anything to change the world about them, to affect the world about them in one way or another? And, you know, we have to sort of... Today, we're so used to an administrative state in which presidents or members of Congress have lots of data about the way the world works, and they have lots of administrative agencies that are capable of shaping the world one way or another, that, you know, it's hard for us to imagine how primitive the governmental apparatus would have been 80 years ago. So, you know, when Franklin Roosevelt became president in early 1933, everyone agrees the country's a mess. And he's elected president, and he says he's going to try and put things right. But he lacked, you know, the most basic information about the state of the country. He didn't know how many businesses there were or how many businesses had failed. He didn't know how many workers there were or how many workers were unemployed. And he didn't really have any administrative tools for helping anybody. He couldn't say, well, I'm going to do a tax cut and kind of get aid into the economy that way, because most people didn't file tax returns. He couldn't send out checks to households because he didn't have that administrative capacity. He couldn't increase Social Security payments because they didn't have a Social Security apparatus. Couldn't run a works program because he didn't have agencies to do that, and so on. So that's a problem of mastery. Here's a guy who's nominally in charge, but doesn't have the administrative capabilities to understand what's going on in the world around him and do anything about it. And one of the things that happens in the period roughly between the 1920s and the 1940s is you get this buildup of governmental capabilities, and that gives meaning to democracy, because you've got people who are elected by the public at large, who are put into office, but who also have the capacity to surveil the world around them and actually do something to improve the world around them.
So when we think about the idea of mastery, let me rephrase the question and just ask it directly. Is mastery the same as expertise?
Yeah, it involves expertise, right? You've got to have experts on tap who can tell you what's going on in the world.
Okay.
So in the 1930s, you know, the big issue, well, you know, one of the big issues was the state of the economy. But, you know, nobody actually talked about the economy before the mid-1930s. The idea of an economy, this idea of a kind of closed system that you could measure and manage, was completely alien to popular discourse before the 1930s. It's hard to get your head around that, but one of the things that happened in the 1930s was we invented the idea of an economy. Experts helped to do this, and then we figured out how to measure it, and then we developed the tools to manage it. And that's one of the big kind of revolutions in government in the 1930s, and that's about mastery. You know, the current version would be, okay, we sense that something's going on with the climate, but we don't know what, so we need experts to tell us, to study the matter and figure out, you know, how does this system work? How are we affecting the system? What can we do about it? I should say, just... there was actually concern about climactic change in the 1930s change at the time in the 1930s because of the drought in the American Midwest, and people were trying to figure out what's going on. The climate's clearly changing. It's having catastrophic effects in the center of the country, but we don't know what's going on. We don't know what we did to contribute to it. Some people thought it might be radio that was doing it, changing the atmosphere. But, you know, so that's a problem of mastery as well.
When we and we have about 15 minutes or 15-16 minutes left, Al, and I do, but I do want a quick follow-up question. So Lorelei Kelly, as I'm sure you know, has written about the destruction of expertise within Congress, and she points to the contract with America and Newt Gingrich having closed, literally shut down research arms within Congress as an institutional problem. What do you make of that critique? Again, under the heading of where we are, but also where we've been, is that a fair? Do you see that as a legitimate issue, not only of mastery, but also, and it ties into your third point, discipline?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of the difficulty is that you've got to have experts on tap, and you've got to listen to the experts that you've got on tap. And we should be legitimately concerned about the degradation of expertise in the federal government at the moment and the apparent unwillingness of policymakers, elected officials, to listen to the experts who are in government. And that's a serious problem. You know, I think the counterpoint would be that we need to remember that expertise permeates society, right? It's not just in federal government, it's in civil society as well. And it's at different levels of government as well. So when you're thinking about the kind of state of the country, you want to attend to what's going on in federal government, but it's not just about what's going on in the federal government.
Let's turn, Al, in our remaining time, to this idea of discipline, and that's probably the most at least terminology wise is the most unusual point, because we don't really think of government from a discipline standpoint. So how do you define that, and what does that mean under the context of malaise?
Yeah, and this is the conservative critique of the 1970s that democracy was out of control, voters asking too much of government, interest groups asking too much of government. Selfish politicians kind of catering to voters by giving them whatever they want, and the result being excessive regulation, a rapid growth in government spending, rapid growth in government debt, and this sense that somehow government itself had to be disciplined, that basically democratic government had to learn how to control itself. And that's what brings us into the era of Reagan and Thatcher. You know, this notion that we need to find ways of controlling the budget, that we need to find ways of limiting regulation, that we need to find ways of kind of government is this kind of thing that will sprawl if we don't take active steps to check it. And that's what drives the advent of the kind of neoliberal paradigm after, or what I called the Reagan-Clinton paradigm after 1980.
The notion of discipline also was one that I found particularly interesting from, again, the standpoint of what bureaucracies can actually do and not do. And this goes back to your institution's point, which I want to focus on here for a moment, because I think it's an important one. We do, I think, have a belief that institutions are rigid, but we also, I think, have a belief that institutions themselves are degrading, not just within government, but within society. And it goes back to these visions of the internet, I think, as the great equalizer, where people would no longer affiliate in traditional brick and mortar institutions, but the internet would be this global community. Now, obviously, we've seen that those utopian visions have failed to transpire. But do you think that institutions themselves are themselves declining in the face of these various distractions and attacks on traditional models of what they mean?
I don't know if I can answer that question in general.
Yeah. No, I understand. What would be your critique of the question itself?
I guess, so what are we worrying about? That the feeling that everybody thinks that they're an expert, that they are no longer willing to defer to expertise, or not willing to defer to institutions?
And
directions by institutions.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe to be a little more specific, you know, you your quote that you have at the beginning of your chapter on discipline, and I'll just read it. It's from you quote James Reston. When Lord Bryce wrote his classic volumes, he thought America was setting a course of responsible liberty that would be the model for the world. Now the outlook for liberty and democracy is bleak and depressing. Has popular democracy gone too far? Perhaps I should have just asked you that question. But that's kind of where I've headed. You know, have we, or where I'm heading with this question, have we gotten from the era of initiative and referendum, all right, where people, rather than going to legislatures or having legislatures represent them, could just, you know, through popular act enact law, to a point where we have gone too far with democracy, where everyone has a voice, such that the issue of discipline within institutions is one that becomes difficult or impossible to solve?
Yeah, I don't, you know, and just to note, so that quote is from 40 years ago, right?
Right,
so
yeah, that's from 1975, yeah, right.
I mean, it works great today, but it's actually from 40 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that sort of ties into the point that we've been here before. But,
right,
you know, it's not clear to me that we are kind of flouting expertise or refusing to defer to institutions in all domains. You know, let me give you a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. So one of the complaints in the 1970s, it wasn't unusual for central banks to be directly controlled by politicians. And central banks, you know, set interest rates. They're charged, among other things, with controlling inflation. Inflation got out of control in the 1970s, and the perception was that this was partly because politicians were just lousy at exercising the kind of self-control that was necessary to keep inflation in check. And one of the results of that was a really substantial change in institutional design all over the world, in which we gave central banks independence, in which we basically said to central bankers, we're going to give you autonomy. Your job is to control inflation. You know, your job is to deal with the problem that we don't trust ourselves to manage by ourselves. And that was the era of the powerful central banker, the kind of the era of Greenspan. And you know, we haven't abandoned that era. You know, we have not tried. I mean, there have been pressures to do it, but we have not repoliticized the domain of monetary policy. We're prepared to give that to experts. You know, it's interesting to observe that the field of military affairs is an area in which we defer to expertise at the federal level. You know, the Department of Defense, the military apparatus, is essentially it's a body of experts, and there's still substantial deference to them as well. So, you know, there's areas where we challenge expertise and areas where we don't. And I suppose an interesting question is, you know, what determines which areas we decide to push back and which areas we decide not.
Right. Yeah. And that I think that's a big issue, and one that I've thought about and I'm writing on myself. We are well into the unfair portion of the show, Al, where I ask you questions that you don't have time to answer adequately. And so what I'm going to do here is, and because we've already talked about it a little bit, so I don't feel so bad about it. You've defined anticipation, and you've mentioned it already as basically a failure or a problem in governments of dealing with long-term problems. And maybe I'll just ask you this question, because I do want to talk about adaptable democracy. You focus a lot on the environmental issues and arguments about environmental policy going back several decades, and you point out that the green critique of democracy has two aspects. You say one is retrospective, that it condemns democracy for creating the risk of complete environmental collapse. But you said the second is prospective. It questions whether democracy is capable of managing that risk competently in the years ahead. Again, you're not a futurist. I don't expect you to be one. But my God, I mean, isn't it hard to see that that democracy, as we understand it right now, is going to be able to deal with these issues?
Well, you know, I think governments generally are doing a lousy job of dealing with the issue of climate change. I don't know if I want to say that democratic government does a particularly bad job of dealing with climate change. We need to remember that we've got difficulties at home with Trump and the Paris Accord, but democratic governments in Europe and also in North America, like Canada, are sticking with the Paris Accord. And it is also the case that authoritarian regimes, non-democratic regimes, have a checkered record on environmental issues generally, and climate change in particular. I mean, in fact, the environmental record of authoritarian regimes like the Soviet Union is pretty appalling. So there's no perfect answer to this. I mean, one of the things you can say about open societies is that they do a generally better job of making sure that information is generated so that people understand the dimensions of the problem. But I think the general predicament here is the capacity of humanity to look forward and plan appropriately with regard to these long-term problems.
So let me ask you this question now, really unfair, because it's going to be you have about 4 minutes to deal with it. But again, I think we've alluded to it. Adaptability and adaptable democracy, how do you define that, and what's at the core of that point?
Yeah, you want a system of government that is capable of looking down the road, and this is partly a problem of expertise, that has the capacity internally to look down the road, to foresee the consequences of, you know, trends of, and also the consequences of government actions today. And you need decision makers, leaders who are properly incentivized, you know, aware of the need to look to the long term, to look down the road. You could also make an argument that this is sort of a problem of representation, and the problem is that you've got a political system in which the people who are going to live with the consequences of our actions are essentially they don't have votes; they're not represented in the political process today. You know, the generation two or three generations out doesn't have the capacity to weigh in on the decisions we're making today. And there are governments that are thinking creatively about how to deal with that. Again, it's a problem of institutional design. You know, there's some interesting thinking about how can we introduce, so for example, new checks and balances in a democratic system so that the interests of future generations are properly weighed into decision-making today.
So let me ask you this question now, among the most unfair questions I could ask. I'm curious what your perspective is on it or advice. Many folks post-election, I think, would find your book incredibly educational on top of everything else to understand its history. And in fact, I've been recommending it to a number of people I know who are kind of new to political action and activism post-election. What do you say to someone who is entering the fray, as it were, over the last 6 months? And what do you advise them to do given these crises? What should the average voter that wants to have an impact on policy do?
Well, I think there's two things. We've got a president who is out of his depth. He's swimming in the wrong end of the pool. That's the kind of the most generous thing I think you can say. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who are trying to figure out how you deal in the short term, now, with this president who is incompetent or making potentially dangerous decisions. And there's the question of Russian interference and so on. Those are problems of the moment, and they have to be dealt with. But I think the key thing is don't get distracted entirely by the problem of the moment. You know, the reason we got into this predicament was because of the exhaustion of a paradigm, and we need to think about big ideas. We need to be looking for those political entrepreneurs out there, the people who are coming onto the political scene, who are thinking creatively about what the big idea that should shape government policy will be. I'm tempted to say, don't look at the kind of cadre that's 70 years or older and look only to them, but look for the next generation of folks who are trying to think creatively about big ideas. So you've got to play this game on two levels. We've got to deal with the politics of the moment. What do we do about President Trump? But we also have to look ahead in the realm of ideas and ask, what's the new paradigm that can help us think about what government should do for the next 20 or 30 years?
And on that note, we have our charge for not only Hearsay Culture listeners, but generally. Al Roberts, the author of Four Crises of American Democracy, Representation, Mastery, Discipline, Anticipation, I should have said at the beginning, congratulations on your new position that you'll be starting in the fall as the director of Social School of Public Policy at UMass Amherst. And thank you for being on the show today and educating my listeners.
Thanks for the conversation. It was a pleasure talking with you.
So we have a number of guests coming up soon on Hearsay Culture, among them Professor Ramesh Srinivasan, author of the book Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Jennifer Granick, author of the book American Spies and Others. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter, 2 p.m. Pacific, Fridays at kzsulive.stanford.edu. Or if you're in the Bay Area, you can listen through old-fashioned radio. It's not that old-fashioned. I shouldn't knock it. It's still quite vibrant, so my apologies to radio fans, and I'm among them. But you can also get the show via podcast by going to Apple iTunes as well as all of the podcast apps that are out there. I always welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback, and otherwise at dave@hearsayculture.com or by going to the webpage for the show at hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.